Welcome to the Hardball Times Audio, your weekly stop for baseball's biggest stories, past and present, with your hosts, Jen MacRamos, Sarah Wexler, and Mary Craig. There were some pretty significant injuries this week. The most notable ones were Dodgers third baseman Justin Turner fracturing his left wrist on a hit-by-pitch, Giants ace Madison Bumgarner suffering a broken left hand on a comeback line drive. Turner is out for at least 4 to 5 weeks, possibly more, while Bumgarner is likely out for 6 to 8 weeks. What do these injuries mean for their respective teams?
They're not ideal. I don't think I need to get too much into how, you know, just huge Justin Turner has been for the Dodgers. He's been one of their top offensive performers, if not their best. You know, they went without him for a bit last season and they got by, but, you know, you're not going to replace the kind of production that he can put up no matter what, you know, combination of, you know, Kyle Farmer, Kike Hernandez, Chris Taylor, whoever you manage to cobble together to, like, or Logan Forsythe, I guess, is the other one that they might slot over at third base. But, yeah, you're obviously not going to reproduce his production. It's just kind of a matter of getting by and having someone to make sure that balls don't get by third base for the time that he's gone. And I think maybe the bigger concern is how Turner heals from it. Wrist injuries can be really tricky and, you know, you can come back from it and it can still take a while to get fully back to form. And a lot of people have pointed to Freddie Freeman's injury that he suffered last year and how he kind of wasn't the same hitter for a while after the fact. And that's a bit discouraging to think about. So, even when the Dodgers get Turner back, you know, you hope that he can, since, you know, it's non-displaced, you know, maybe the healing will go pretty quickly and he won't, you know, he won't need surgery or anything. So, like, you know, there won't be like that added aspect to worry about. But nonetheless, you just never know how long it's going to take him to round into form after the fact. So, yeah, that is not great. The Bumgarner thing is also not great because, you know, that Giants pitching staff, that, yeah.
The Giants are doomed. The Giants are doomed to death. And they're going to be held together with duct tape and glue and popsicle sticks. And I'm expecting McCutchen to be traded by the deadline. I think that this is really going to be a test of the Giants' depth and also trying to see if Tyler Beattie is ready. And while many people know I absolutely love Ty Block, he is not an opening day starter.
Oh, yes, he is.
Well, okay, by definition, he is technically an opening day starter, technically, because he's scheduled
opening day. He's the opening day starter.
I predict 162 days of me yelling at my TV or at the radio or at my phone, because the Giants are terrible, and it's just going to be like me 10 years ago yelling, why can't you get run support for Tim Lincecum, except this year it's going to be, why can't you get good pitching? So the Giants are doomed. That's where I'm at.
I'm glad we began this on an optimistic note.
Yeah. it is just kind of wild to me that the opening day starting matchup went from being Clayton Kershaw versus Madison Bumgarner, which is, you know, one of these kind of like frontline, like rivalry ace off things. And now it's Clayton Kershaw versus Ty Block. And, you know, like you said, Ty Block is, you know, a fantastic guy and, you know,
great back end of the rotation guy, like fourth, fifth starter, but not an ace.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's a tough position to have to thrust that guy into. Although, as people have pointed out, he has done well against Kershaw as a hitter.
Yes, mister, I have a 600 batting average against Kershaw, I think that was the tweet said.
Yeah, I can't remember what that comes out to.
Three home runs, and that's going to be the only runs that the Giants score. because, you know, that's how baseball works.
And that's how the Giants work.
And yet, to me, like, if that happened, like, as a Dodger fan, that would be so much worse for me than if, you know, Kershaw just gave up runs to, like, actual hitters.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, I would, you know, the Dodgers could win, you know, 17-3. All three runs could have come on tie block home runs off of Kershaw. And I would still be disappointed because, you know,
giving up
baseball
fans
are selfish.
Pitcher.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
And I just saw news that said Bumgarner had surgery on a broken left pinky. So that's fantastic. Mm. Oh, baseball.
That's such a baseball injury. Like a broken left pinky.
Yeah. Yeah, we talked about this some on the podcast that's coming out Thursday because we actually recorded it on Saturday because that's just how life works sometimes. But it's just kind of amazing to me that, you know, this is the second year in a row that Bumgarner is going to miss a couple months because of an injury that's kind of really bizarre, but he at least gets some credit for this injury being a lot less dumb than the last one.
Yeah, yeah, this is definitely better than injuring yourself with a dirt bike.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's just both Bumgarner and Samardzija are out, and, like, the rotation, as far as I can tell right now, it's like Stratton, Cueto, Block. I have no idea who else. So
I guess this is kind of a question of, like, if you know that your team is not going to be all that competitive, is it better from a team perspective and a fan perspective to at least have Madison Bumgarner to cling on to, you know, right from the beginning of the season, or to see a bunch of different guys and see, you know, a variety of pitchers, what your organization has, whether these guys will be in play in seasons to come, you know, to kind of get a better understanding of where you're actually at as a team.
Yeah, I think, like, especially in these type of situations, I think it's the right opportunity to showcase these guys who are, you know, top prospects, getting ready to get into the show, but need, like, a low-pressure situation so that they have the time to adjust. You know, throwing in a top prospect in the middle of a pennant race, can, it's hit or miss, but when you have a lot of guys kind of gradually come up and there's not really a lot of expectation for them to do well, but other than, you know, hey, get some reps in, get some work in, try to make adjustments. And I think that's, you know, that's important to be able to do that and to recognize as a team, like, okay, we might not be contending this year, but at least let's, you know, throw in the young guys and see how they fit into everything. But I also know that the Giants are a team that do not want to rebuild. The Giants are doomed.
But it circles back to that.
Yeah, yeah. So, Giants. In other discouraging baseball news, MLB announced rulings on both Steven Wright's domestic violence case and Miguel Sano's sexual assault case. Wright received a 15-game suspension following his December arrest for domestic assault, which he will not appeal. Sano was not punished due to, quote, insufficient evidence following an accusation of assault made in December about an incident in 2015. In the case of Wright, who is a 15-game suspension, does it even come close to sufficient?
Absolutely not. It's the equivalent of 3 starts, which is nothing. He assaulted his wife and prevented her from calling 911. Like, that is very serious. We have proof that that is what he did. Because his wife is not taking any other action against him, you know, suddenly it's okay what he did, and it doesn't merit any further punishment. It's ridiculous that domestic violence is treated so much less seriously than using PEDs. It's 1/4, you know, or 1/5 or whatever of a PED suspension, which is, absolutely ridiculous. It just shows that Major League Baseball, once again, does not remotely care about its non-male fans. To have both of these as a news dump on Friday, you know, before the season begins, just further proves that Major League Baseball could not care less about this, that they're just trying to sweep it under the rug to make it, you know, not a huge deal. And for the Red Sox, for Steven Wright to still be on the Red Sox after this, and for the Red Sox to not have any sort of internal punishment of their own to hand out to him is appalling.
Yeah, I just feel like baseball needs to do better. And, you know, as I've written before about how baseball needs to do better about sexual violence, especially in the case of Miguel Sano, it needs to do better about gendered violence as a whole. You know, there's so many things that they can do. They can consult, you know, experts in this field as to what the right approach is. They can have training sessions about domestic violence and how to stop themselves, you know, how to have men stop themselves from committing domestic violence or sexual assault. And just, there are solutions is what I'm trying to say. It's just that it doesn't seem to be that MLB is implementing any of these solutions, and it just does not seem to help their case about them being good about these kind of things, especially if, you know, Wright is getting 15 games, which is really just 3 starts, suspension, when a PED suspension could get up to 80 games or, you know, ban for life. So, you know, it just goes to show what MLB's priorities are, and they need to do better.
They do. They need to. There needs to be less of a focus of how these players are contributing to their teams and more of a focus on what they're doing to their, you know, respective partners, or, you know, how that impacts female baseball fans, how that impacts, you know, women and NBs in just in general in life, in the world, in this country. And, Major League Baseball is dropping the ball hugely, and I hope that at some point they realize that they have to do better in this area, but I'm not sure they'll get there without there being some sort of substantial cost to them in how they are handling these things, and I don't know when that will happen, but I think that they will eventually, if this keeps up, drive away female fandom.
Yeah, it's just, it's something that helps no one. So,
yep.
In yet more discouraging baseball news, Braves top prospect Ronald Acuña was sent to the minors this week despite a torrid showing in spring training. This seems to pretty clearly be a case of service time manipulation, meaning that even though Acuña seems ready to get a crack at the big leagues, the Braves are waiting to promote him until after April 13th, at which point they will get an extra year of contractual control with him. This is hardly the first time we've seen something like this. A similar thing happened with Chris Bryant in 2015, although it was worse as Bryant was 3 years older than Acuña is now. How is service time manipulation anything but bad for baseball?
It's just 100% bad. It's terrible. It's, you know, a violation of these players' rights. And it just seems so like odd and short-sighted on the behalf of these teams, because there's no guarantee that, you know, 5-6 years from now, you know, having this player on your team will actually be worth anything. So it seems like getting these extra few weeks from the players is not something that is going to hinder the team in any, you know, noticeable in any meaningful way. So it just really seems like it's owners exerting their control of these players and letting these players know that they are essentially powerless in this relationship.
Yeah, it's maddening, and it makes me very mad to see. I just, I just can't help but think about how this is all tied into teams thinking of players as property and that it doesn't really do anything. But, you know, I feel like if they were really concerned about contractual control with a player and, you know, keeping him on the team for such a long time, pay the player. Just give them a longer contract. You know, there's no harm in extending the contract for X amount of years past the contractual control. And, you know, that makes, you know, that's good for the team and makes the player happy instead of manipulating the service time. And I really, really hate that service time manipulation is a thing that exists in this sport.
So. Yeah, it just shows how little owners think of players as human beings. And I think it's something that MLBPA needs to push back on, you know, as soon as they possibly can. And I think that players are certainly becoming not only more aware of the fact that it is manipulation, but aware of the need to vocalize these opinions and to kind of radicalize one another in terms of just how unfair it is to these players.
I completely agree. You know, I think one of the things that needs to happen is that these players should know, you know, that they should be speaking out about all of this. They should be taking a stand saying, hey, this is dehumanizing. This is not good. This is just completely, completely an awful thing to do. And, you know, while we're seeing that with a lot of things such as, you know, the wages in minor leagues and players speaking out a little bit more about that, you know, I really, really hope that they start speaking out a lot about injustices such as service time manipulation, because it does kind of play a role into all of the wage stuff as well.
Yeah, exactly. And I think in the long term, it's a bad strategy for the owners. Obviously, Major League Baseball does not take this seriously, and the MLBPA still has to kind of get around to actually acting on this, because Chris Bryant's grievance still hasn't been acted on, which is kind of ridiculous. But I think that it's going to start, you know, radicalizing these players. And the smart thing to do, which is not necessarily, you know, the most humane thing to do or the most moral thing to do, is for the owners to do away with service time manipulation in order to maybe prevent players from seeing service time manipulation as part of a larger picture of power and of control that owners have on these players. So I think it would be smart for the owners to kind of get rid of this in exchange for something else. But I think that we are seeing, particularly with the Chris Bryant situation, you know, players and fans starting to understand this in the broader picture.
Completely agreed. And, yeah, I think, you know, the best solution would be just to make sure that this is a practice that stops happening. But, you know, capitalism, money, profits, but can only hope that, you know, more players are starting to talk about this and talk about how it affects everyone in baseball. So now, in much less distressing baseball news, the Rangers released new ballpark menu items for this upcoming season that received a lot of divisive discussion on Twitter. The list includes the Cheetos Jalapeno Bacon Dog, which is a hot dog wrapped in bacon topped with nacho cheese sauce and Cheetos. The Seventh Inning Cinnamon Roll, a deep-fried cinnamon roll with chocolate sauce. And the Triple B sandwich with bacon, brisket, and bologna. What do we think of these new menu items, and what do we look for in ballpark food?
I think they've gone too far. This is just ridiculous. There's no need for it, especially the Triple B sandwich, because like the slices of bologna are basically the size of a hockey puck, and that's just like pure madness. That is just power corrupting power. There's absolutely no need. That's just revolting.
I would try those ham fries, which are like little strips of ham dipped in batter, and I think that one is.
That's fine. We have chicken fries. I feel like you can have ham fries.
I feel like there's a value to a meaty fry, but as a whole, I mean, the Seventh Inning Cinnamon Roll sounds like it would be good. I am scared of the idea of a Cheetos Jalapeno Bacon Dog, but I think that's more of my level of spice intolerance than anything. But it's just, I mean, I will say I know that ballpark food tourism is an actual thing. You know, people will go to ballparks just to try the wackiest food on the menu, and, you know, I totally understand why they're doing it, but it's also like, why?
Yeah, I mean, these things are 100% designed with the idea that people are going to be Instagramming them and Snapchatting and tweeting. And, you know, I sound like an old person right now, just like naming social media platforms. But it's, you know, it is very much designed with the thought that, oh, people are going to be sharing pictures of this and people are going to be like, oh, wow, that's crazy. And so it's just, you know, it is more a publicity stunt than anything. I don't think they actually expect people to, I mean, people will eat them because, you know, they'll be morbidly curious, I think. But, you know, the point is not to design things that taste good. It is to design things that are outrageous. And that's what they've done. As for the actual quality of these things and whether I would try them, probably not super qualified to comment on 2 out of 3 because I do not eat meat and I have never had bacon in my life, which I think I've mentioned on here. Just, you know, never I kind of did the kosher thing, so didn't ever have any pork products. So I'm not qualified to say whether or not those other things sound disgusting, though they do. That said, I would also try the Seventh Inning Cinnamon Roll because I like chocolate and I like sugar and I like fried things. And I once tried deep fried cheesecake at a Wisconsin county fair. So I feel like I do not have a super discerning palate when it comes to ridiculous food items. So when it comes to dessert, I think I have a kind of broader acceptance of craziness. So the cinnamon roll can stay, but the other things I'm kind of side eyeing.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think the cinnamon roll came on a stick, which I like because I think that one of my major issues with these, you know, super complex, absolutely, you know, wacky, like, you know, concoctions is that they just seem like they're so difficult to eat at a ballpark. Like they
it
seem like something
like
that's
messy.
Yeah, exactly. And like, and that just kind of not only is meant, like, I wouldn't want to be sitting next to somebody like chowing down on one of these and like just like getting things everywhere, you know? That just seems disgusting to me. And I think that it is very distracting if you actually want to watch the baseball game, because they just seem like they would also take a long time to eat. And then you'd have to like go and wash your hands and like wash your clothing because you probably spilled things on your shirt and your pants, and it's just a mess.
Yeah, I think portability is a huge thing to consider in what I look for in ballpark food. I think, you know, we need to be thinking about how easy it is to eat things when you're sitting in a seat and you don't have a table necessarily, unless you like get the super fancy people seats where they actually give you tables in front, but like who can afford that? I think for me personally, something I look for in ballpark food is decent vegetarian options, because the truth of the matter is a lot of ballparks don't have that. And, you know, it's not to say that they don't have vegetarian options, but often it's things like, you know, a veggie wrap that you get like pre-made and it's like not that good, or, you know, a veggie hot dog, which, you know, I enjoy that from time to time, but I kind of want a bit more variety. I know that the Dodgers have added in a number of things in recent years. I still haven't gotten to try the vegan nachos that they introduced that are supposed to apparently be quite good. And I just bring up the Dodgers because that's, you know, the ballpark that I've worked in and, you know, eaten more meals there than anywhere else. And I guess it's supposed to be the most vegetarian friendly ballpark in baseball. But even there, I still feel like my options are pretty limited. So I don't know. It'd be nice to see more options that are not so meat centric. So yeah, come up with some crazy dish that's vegetarian. I would love to try it.
I feel like I am spoiled with AT&T Park because I don't eat all meats. And I have a tendency to just go for more vegetarian leaning stuff. And then, you know, in AT&T Park, you've got like vegetable sandwiches, and then there's tacos and burritos and portobello sandwiches and hummus, and, you know, there's the cha-cha bowl. And, you know, the cha-cha bowl is like one of the biggest go-to items at AT&T Park. And essentially what the cha-cha bowl is like trying to find a way, the best way to describe it. But it's, you know, you can take out the meat in this, but it's rice and beans and like a pineapple zucchini salsa, you know, all in a bowl. And yeah, it's just, you know, options. But for me, in terms of food that I look for, you know, also, you know, the ability to look for food that's not necessarily meat heavy, because I don't eat red meat. I specifically stick to like chicken, pork, and fish. So alternate options to beef heavy things is great. I usually just look for things that are tasty and affordable. Affordability, important thing. You know, one of my favorite go-to food things at a ballpark is, I will say I'm biased towards all the things that I can get at a minor league ballpark, but I do love the fact that the Modesto Nuts have their own food truck on site and have a lot of options that are more, that are different than, you know, typical ballpark fare, than, you know, sandwiches and hot dogs. And I will not get into the hot dogs and sandwich debate right there. I didn't realize what I said. But yeah, I mean, there's like teriyaki rice bowls available and like zapolis and salads and just so many different things. And the tacos are great and they're affordable.
Bonus points for that.
Yeah. So I'm just going to go with tasty and affordable and options.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think I just want, like, these foods all seem very aggressive, and I just can't get on board with that. Like, they're just so in your face, and they're just like, look at me, and I just, that's not something I look for in a food. I just want something to be like, oh, look, I'm, you know, good, I'm affordable, you can, like, you know, watch a game and casually eat me, you know?
I just enjoyed the food talking in Mary's head.
I mean,
it takes me a long time to like process a meal, so that's most of my day taken up, you know, just with these running dialogues.
I mean, I will also say one of my favorite things about ballpark food is how specific it is to our region. Mm-hmm. Like, the Stockton Ports have fried asparagus because they're, you know, the asparagus capital of America. They grow so much asparagus, so why not showcase that in the local, in the ballpark food?
Yeah.
And, you know, the Modesto Nuts, home to a lot of almond orchards and walnuts, and they have stuff like that. And, you know, the San Jose Giants, all I can think about is how they have churros that are probably the best I've ever had in the world. And it's like 2 for $5, and they're sold warm out of Sterilite drawer by an amazing man who wears a 10-gallon hat that's signed by the entire team. And I just think things like that as gimmicks are better than, like, outrageous food.
Yeah. I mean, I guess that's the problem with the Rangers specifically, is that Texas food is known to be outrageous. And so you have to start with that as a baseline and then try and play it up even more, which is, I think, where they run into a lot of issues with this stuff. So, I mean, I think they have a lot of things kind of counting. Because Texas is just like, let's add a chicken to a cow to a pig and, you know, let's just stuff it in this and throw like 10 pounds of cheese on it.
Oh my God.
So essentially they're trying to create the ballpark version of the turducken.
Yeah.
If I'm getting that correctly.
Yeah. I mean, just to give you kind of a small example, at the grocery stores here, they sell smokers that are in the shape of animals that will be smoked in them.
Oh my God.
Yeah. It's great. Cause my sister's vegan. And so she's never not repulsed by the sight of those.
Man, I've tried to eat vegetarian in the South. I don't know how anybody manages to live there full time being vegan and like just like get by, because that just, it just seems like such a huge part of the culture is like meat, meat, meat. And I'm really impressed that your sister can navigate that.
Yeah, I think it's becoming like easier as it gets, you know, a little more popular. But people are still generally like very confused by just the concept of veganism. And so that's a lot of explanation going through. Okay, they get like, oh, you don't eat meat, but then it's like, oh, you don't eat eggs. Like, what? Oh, there's no honey, huh? And like, and there's just like, they sneak animal products into like basically everything. And so like, if you get guacamole, it'll have like sour cream or something in it, or like cheese and salsa. And so, like, that's kind of the things that you know, put her right over the edge. She's just like, there's no need for this.
Yeah.
Not to get totally off topic.
Oh, food politics. In short, ballparks, teams, make affordable, tasty food and give options to people with, you know, different dietary needs and make them very tasty.
Yeah, and I'll just give a quick shout out to, I know the Dodgers added a kosher cart recently to the ballpark, and that is really great because not only does that accommodate people who are kosher, it also accommodates people who are halal. So it's nice to see those sort of accommodations exist. So yeah, make food options inclusive. It's a good thing to do.
That rules. I didn't know about that, and that is amazing. More of that, please. We are again joined by practicing lawyer and Fangraphs writer Cheryl Ring to discuss the biggest baseball news of the week, the minor league wage exemption in the congressional spending bill. Cheryl, how are you doing?
I am just fine. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks so much for coming back on. You know, this is obviously a really big thing that kind of, you know, goes beyond the scope of, I think, what a lot of people have the legalistic understanding to fully grasp. So, you know, we wanted to sort of get into the details of it with you. So by virtue of not being part of either the MLBPA or having a union of its own, minor leaguers have for some time received far lower wages than they should. There is a case, and versus the Office of the Commissioner of Baseball, currently working its way through the courts. For those who don't know the details, can you provide an overview of this case?
Oh, sure. So the Senny case, it was brought by an attorney named Garrett Brocious, who, fun fact, he actually was a minor league baseball player before he went to law school. And he filed this lawsuit, and it's under a statute called Fair Labor Standards Act, as well as a number of state statutes and state common law provisions, which is just a fancy way of saying that he has a number of different causes of action. And the basis of his lawsuit is that the minor league baseball players are being unlawfully paid less than the minimum wage. And he is trying to get it certified as a class action, which would allow a named plaintiff, Senny, to sue on behalf of himself, but also all of the other minor leaguers in the same or substantially similar situation. So if it were to be certified, theoretically, you could be talking about a class of all minor leaguers in a particular time period or who played for particular teams. And depending on the size of the certified class, that could be potentially very large. Right now, it's on appeal before the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals to determine whether or not the class is certifiable, which is just a fancy legalese way of saying that it's on appeal for the Ninth Circuit to decide whether or not they can sue on behalf of a bunch of minor leaguers or whether Senny can only sue on his own behalf.
This is obviously not the first time that MLB owners have lobbied Congress to exempt minor leaguers from labor laws. In 2016, there was the Save America's Pastime Act. What are some of the differences between that act and this provision?
That's actually a really good question. And the reason it's a really good question is because they kept the name. If you look at page, I think it's 1967 of the omnibus bill, it says at the top, Save America's Pastime Act, as though it's the same law. But it actually is slightly different. And what it's essentially doing is trying to exempt minor leaguers from overtime regulations, which would, for practical purposes, and Nathaniel Groh, my colleague, had a really nice article about this on Fangraphs after the actual language made it into the bill, it would turn minor leaguers into seasonal employees. Now, the bad news is, because they're seasonal employees, that pretty much caps their wages, although it doesn't mean that they are entitled to make less than minimum wage for the work they actually put in. So in that sense, that question is still somewhat of an open question. But if they're seasonal employees, one of the big impacts this could have is it could essentially end independent baseball as we know it. If you're talking about the Atlantic League or the Frontier League, leagues with really low payroll caps that can't afford to pay their minor leaguers, that their players rather, like even minor leaguers are paid, or who have a limited amount of money, they can't afford to treat their players as seasonal employees. And the way the bill was drafted, it doesn't apply only to affiliated baseball. It applies to all professional or semi-professional baseball. So this is a situation where all of a sudden independent leagues are really threatened. And it's interesting that it was worded that way, especially given how increasingly in recent years the independent leagues have been a pipeline for talent to Major League Baseball and affiliated organizations. And I'm wondering if that is an intended or an unintended consequence of the wording that they ended up deciding on.
Yeah, that seems really interesting, just how it will impact independent leagues. So how do you think that might influence the future of this? Do you think that independent league teams and owners might lobby politically or legally to kind of curb this? Do you think that there is a better kind of path to go through the courts or to appeal to Congress to have this act repealed or replaced with something else?
Well, that's also a really good question, because this isn't exactly the statute anybody was expecting, I think, for the Save America's Pastime Act. It's somewhat different than what was proposed originally. But it's also the result of a lot of lobbying by Major League Baseball. And I'm not sure that independent leagues have that kind of clout when you look at the amount of money that Major League Baseball spent on lobbying, they hired a very prestigious lobbying firm, I think called the Rubenstein Group, to represent them. And it's they spent a lot of time and effort getting this passed, and I don't see this being repealed anytime soon, unfortunately, given the amount of effort that went into it. As in terms of how it applies to independent leagues, they may have to make the argument that it isn't, they aren't within the intended ambit of the statute. They may have to go semi-pro in order to try and avoid the ambit of the statute, but it remains to be seen how courts are going to apply this. And there's also the question that in the law, some lawyers call it the baseball question, which is baseball has always had this sort of special treatment in the law. And increasingly, courts have started to push back on that a little. Some courts have said, we don't like it, but it's the ambit of Congress to change it. Some courts have said, well, we don't like just giving this one sport, even a sport that is the national pastime, special treatment, as it were. So it remains to be seen just how strictly courts are going to follow this. And they could give this a very expansive view, which would be very bad for independent leagues, or they could give this a very narrow reading, which would be better. But at that point, we're waiting to see how courts apply this, and getting appellate courts to apply this is going to be very expensive and probably something that independent teams can't afford anyway.
Yeah. So on that basis, do you think that this is something that will, you know, mostly kind of be forgotten by the public, you know, in the coming weeks or months? Or do you think that this has a little bit more staying power? You know, it's something that will kind of continue to crop up, you know, both in the courts and, you know, among fans, such as the previous cases that have been related to Major League Baseball and the reserve clause.
Well, the interesting thing is, I mean, and this is just my opinion from reading what they passed, but they miraculously found a way to make the problem that exists worse. It would have been bad for minor leaguers if they had said, well, minor leaguers are exempt from minimum wage laws, they're exempt X, Y, and Z. But instead of doing that, they basically just turned minor leaguers into seasonal employees, and by doing that, left as an open question cases like Senny about whether or not they're entitled to minimum wage. And that means that those cases are going to continue to wind their way through the courts unless you get a really expansive reading of this statute by an appellate court. And I don't see that happening, although I would be surprised if MLB didn't try and use this statute as a basis for dismissal. I just don't think that those cases are going away now because of what the statute did and didn't do. And because of that, you now have this weird situation where you still have the minimum wage question, but now there's a question of, well, we don't have to pay them overtime. What constitutes overtime? And in some ways, Congress has created more problems than they've solved with this, between the independent league question and now turning baseball players into seasonal employees. So I could see a lot more litigation as a result of this statute, not less, as often happens when you have provisions that are stuffed into omnibus bills like this. And it's going to be interesting to see how courts interpret it. And we may see some kind of legislative fix in the coming years, because I don't think that this statute solves the problem. I honestly think it made it worse.
Yeah, I'd have to agree, you know. Made everything worse, and you know, I couldn't agree more. It's just disappointing to see. But, yeah, thank you, Cheryl. You can follow Cheryl on Twitter at @ringCheryl. Cheryl, it was great having you back. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
And now for the past week's articles.
All right. So on Monday, we have Mr. Bitterman's Guide to Surviving the 2018 Season by John Paschal. John, a bitter Rangers fan, provides a guide to the season for all of us who, despite loving baseball, actually kind of hate it. He He encourages this type of fan, most likely attached to a team which has never won the World Series, to resist taking a universalist approach to baseball. Instead, allowing the particularities of the game and your terrible team to sink deeply into you until they become all-consuming. And that's just the first spring training survival tip. The rest of the piece guides you through the remainder of the season, providing tips on how best to maximize the All-Star break and deal with the long, devastating second half of the season and playoffs. Then on Tuesday, we have Mike Trout, Statcast Darling by Eli Ben Porat. Mike Trout, the best hitter in baseball, was 101st in exit velocity last season. Eli examines just how Trout manages to be such a good hitter, and whether we place too much value on a slim standard deviation of exit velocity and launch angle. To do so, he creates the Trout metric, which is average exit velocity multiplied by the standard deviation of average exit velocity divided by the standard deviation of launch angle. To find out just how this calculation plays out in baseball, be sure to read Eli's piece.
All right, then on Wednesday we have A Rebuilding Year, My Way Back to Baseball by Annie Maroon. In this really lovely piece, Annie details the journey that has been her baseball fandom and sports fandom. It's one that has involved using the game she loves as a means of escape, covering sports professionally, struggling with identity, spending some time away, and finally making her way back. Although the specifics of Annie's relationship with sports are highly personal to her, I think most baseball fans will find some aspects of it which they can very much relate to. On Thursday, we have The Most Underrated Base Stealer of the 1980s and 90s by Ryan Pollock. Here, Ryan brings our attention to Vince Coleman, a man whose base stealing prowess is often overlooked because his bat was not especially impressive. Coleman led the National League in stolen bases for each of the first six seasons of his career, and his 752 career stolen bases ranks sixth all-time. Ryan uses a number of measures to compare Coleman to two of his contemporaries known for their base stealing abilities, Ricky Henderson and Tim Raines. You ought to come away from this convinced that Coleman should be regarded as one of the top base thieves of his day. And then on Friday, we have The Kong Identity by Frank Jackson. Frank takes a look at the career of Dave Kingman, one that was marked by a low batting average, a lot of long home runs, and a lot of strikeouts, at least for the time in which he played. With both home runs and strikeouts on the rise in Major League Baseball, it seems there may be some players following in King Kong's footsteps, and Frank attempts to identify the players who most fit the prototype Kingman established. It's hardly a spoiler, since his image is used at the top of the article, but Joey Gallo of the Rangers is the player Frank identifies as the one most likely to carry on Kingman's legacy. Check out the article for more details.
And in the coming week, we have Stephanie Springer exploring the science behind nutritional supplements, which are becoming increasingly popular with players. Our own managing editor, Meg Rowley, is reviewing Russell Carlton's new book, The Shift. Gerald Schiffman looks at StatCast tracking errors. Jason Linden welcomes in the new league year. And John Rogel looks at the 2017 strike zone. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Hardball Times Audio. You can find all the articles mentioned in this episode at fangraphs.com/THT, and you can find the site on Twitter at @hardball_times. I can be found on Twitter at Jen Mac Ramos. You can find Sarah at Sarah Wexler 32. You can find Mary at Mary M. Craig, and you can find the podcast on Twitter at THT Audio. Thanks to our theme music from bentsound.com. You can find all the episodes of the Hardball Times Audio on fangraphs.com/THT and iTunes. Please rate and subscribe. Be sure to tune in this Thursday for a special opening day episode with an exciting surprise guest.